Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Duane DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anofawakin.
This week, the most ridiculous law of 2013 so far. Twitter launches a video service. Microsoft Office and YouTube go to paid subscriptions. Ashton Kutcher and J.J. Abrams induce nerdgasm. And is the new BlackBerry OS X and devices BlackBerry's last stand? Or is it already too late? Let's just jump right into our headlines here because we got a lot of them. In October 2012, the Librarian of Congress, who determines exemptions to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, decided that unlocking mobile phones would no longer be allowed, but the Librarian provided a 90-day window during which people could still buy a phone and unlock it. That window closed on January 26th. So you are no longer allowed to unlock your phones. There's kind of a grandfather in that clause where phones, when you're done with your contract, your carrier can unlock your phone for you, or certain carriers have offered phones like the iPhone. I think T-Mobile is offering the iPhone unlocked as part of their contract, but I think you still have to pay a contract. It's kind of weird.
There are plenty of phones that you can get. You can buy certain phones unlocked, but the idea is that the consumer is no longer free to unlock their devices anymore. This is separate from base jailbreaking. That is to say, right, you can jailbreak your iPhone or you can root your Android phone for the purposes of giving it more functionality, by getting software that's not available in the software stores, getting rid of the skin that like HTC or Samsung puts on top of Android. But you can't take it away or free it from the locked nature that the carrier, your service provider, has worked with the manufacturer to create. So back in the day, like the early 2000s, you could get like an unlock code on eBay or whatever, yeah, for like a Samsung, yeah, phone, and you can just say, okay, my T-Mobile Samsung phone now works on AT&T. That is what the prohibition is against right now, just your portability across networks, which I don't know about you guys, but it seems a little bit like a step backwards.
Yeah, no, I have to say, though, from a practical sense, looking at this, I'm not sure how much this will affect me because I'm already sort of invested in that infrastructure of getting a phone through a carrier and through a contract. So I've never actually purchased an unlocked phone or purchased a phone to unlock it outside
I've done it a couple times. Uh-huh. It's pretty gratifying to know that you can move from one thing to another. I've had to do it for my girlfriend a couple times because she didn't want to get back on contract. You can get a late model like phone for cheaper than the new hotness or whatever, mm-hmm, all that stuff. So I'm definitely going to miss it. I think before the iPhone and before my BlackBerries, it was all unlocked phones. It was like, okay, whatever's cheaper right now. So,
right. And it's really useful and important for those who travel internationally as well.
Yes.
Just being able to unlock your phone and use different services without having to be a part of the horrendous charges that can be levied against you if you're staying in, you know, a U.S. network.
Yeah, I got to say, every time I go abroad, I've been a couple places already this year. It is like a bit of a pain to have to work with AT&T on those phones that haven't been grandfathered as international calling and data plans yet. If you have a Verizon phone, this is another loophole, a la what Andy was saying. If you have a Verizon iPhone 5 or iPhone 4S, the GSM aspect of those phones is unlocked from the time you get it. You're locked into the contract based on the CDMA connectivity that you'll have when you're in the United States. But if you should leave the United States and get a SIM card to pop in your phone, it'll work without an issue. The phone is smart enough to know that there's SIM signal and not a CDMA signal. So if you're on Verizon, you're in a better place than you are with AT&T, where if you go abroad, you really are stuck with only AT&T's international service now, unless you want to pay whatever fee you'd have to pay to like get your phone unlocked and your contract, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know what? I believe that when they 6 years ago when they decided to allow individuals to unlock their phones, I think it was more along the lines of a statement to the to the phone industry and the phone corporations to kind of get their act together. And I think the Librarian always planned to have it as a short-term thing, not long-term. Yeah, that is what I read from a source, that it was always a plan not to be something that was to be lengthy. It was never really a benefit to consumers, more a punishment to the corporations.
Well, that's interesting. What do you guys think? I mean, like right now, I think last September, we hit a point at which there are more prepaid subscribers for cell phones than there are postpaid subscribers. Those prepaid subscribers, you know, since they don't have a contract, they're presumably using unlocked devices, which means the country is moving toward an unlock first, or it's already at an unlock first situation. Or they're using devices that are locked but are disposable. So it's interesting to me to see that this is the way it's going, especially when AT&T wants to move away from subsidies for the telephone, you know, so you have to pay full price for the telephone, but then you're locked in. That seems a little strange to me.
I think the underlying point here that I've got from this is that the Library of Congress, and in particular the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, is somewhat backwards, and it doesn't really reflect modern tech usage. For example, according to this Atlantic article, every 3 years, groups like the American Foundation for the Blind have to lobby Congress to protect an exception for the blind, allowing for books to be read aloud because of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Yeah. Yeah. It's clearly an act that was made by people who weren't looking at, who were looking at maintaining the past business model for content and digital distribution, in a digital world, rather than creating a model that was native to the digital world or whatever, or protecting, you know, the advent of this digital technology. But yeah, it's interesting the Library of Congress has made this move. I think you're right, Andy. It's not going to get in the way of a lot of people's day-to-day today. But given that there are, again, more prepaid users than postpaid users, you can buy these unlocked devices. You know, Google attempted to sell its phone unlocked for so long. They still do. They sell their some of their Nexus devices unlocked. It's interesting to see where people want to go with this, because I would think that if you're going to be conservative about the way business is done when it comes to telephones, you would probably want to focus on the idea that the consumer gets to choose. It's unlocked. You can take your phone to any carrier that'll support the device, and you know that is the sort of like business, that would be to me the business first mentality, without these weird kind of tariffs or protections against the user that says they can't choose their carrier. They have to make a commitment. They can't just kind of move back and forth.
Yeah, it is definitely something very interesting. Kind of what I was trying to imply before, it seems like I think the reason behind it, as the Library of Congress says, is that now carriers are liberal and publicly available with unlocking policies, so you can actually get your phone unlocked through them rather than having to go through, you know,
some third-party source.
Exactly.
Mm. Except now you have to pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah, you still have to go through a carrier in order to do it.
Exactly.
All right, moving on here. Research in Motion is no more. In an unexpected move, the company officially changed their name on Wednesday to that of its flagship mobile brand, BlackBerry, which is kind of a no-brainer move for them. I mean, I can't remember the last time I ever heard anyone refer to it as Research in Motion. It's BlackBerry.
I mean, everyone talks about it as RIM, I guess. Their stock symbol's RIM.
Yeah.
Business side of RIM. But this is just like what you said just now. This isn't going to change anyone's life.
No. But they did unveil the first two smartphones running their new operating system, BlackBerry 10, before a crowd in New York City. CEO Thorsten Heinz showed off the first two BlackBerry 10 devices. The first to ship of the two is the BlackBerry Z10, an all-touch smartphone to be available in the U.S. in March. at $199 at Verizon, and we don't have prices yet for AT&T and T-Mobile, but we can assume they're going to be comparable. Details about the second new smartphone, the BlackBerry Q10, which is a touchscreen phone that comes with a physical QWERTY keyboard similar to older BlackBerry devices, are less clear, although we do know it's due out in April, but exact release date and pricing remain to be seen. Now, BlackBerry is attempting a comeback at a time when the mobile device market is becoming even more crowded with competitors. From Microsoft's attempt to provide a unifying experience across desktop PCs and mobile devices with Windows 8 and Windows Phone 8, to new mobile software recently shown off by open source companies like Mozilla and Canonical. Perhaps that's partially why BlackBerry also took a big chunk of time out of its presentation to introduce newly appointed global creative director, Grammy Award-winning musician Alicia Keys. Keys said she would be working with it. Yes. Yep. You heard that correctly. Keys said she'd be working
with... I gotta go mute for a second, sorry.
Keys said she'd be working within the company and with others outside of it in the entertainment industry to promote the BlackBerry 10 brand, describing her own hot and cold relationship with her BlackBerry in terms of that of a romantic relationship, saying she's been impressed with sexier smartphones, but had now recommitted to BlackBerry. And when I first heard about this, the only thing that I thought of is that it seems to be like a running theme now of obsolete companies pairing with, you know, hot musicians to try and beef up their presence. Like when
you say obsolete companies, what do you mean?
Like when Polaroid made Lady Gaga their creative director, or when Justin Timberlake paired with MySpace. It's like it seems to me like the last desperate gasp of these companies to boost their self-image by
remaining hip and with the cool kids.
That's interesting, because I know I think it's a double-edged sword. Right now, I know Will.i.am is working with one or two tech companies as their digital consultant. They're digital strategists. So I think that on some level, these artists who have come out and thrived in the digital space with digital distribution for music and focusing on who they are as a personality and what they can offer as people with talent rather than just sort of like create music, whatever. I think that there is some movement where these companies are saying, well, who's actually, you know, these are like sort of in some ways the more avant-garde artists. Alicia Keys is known for not following the trends in R&B. She's focused on what some may call a soul focus, whereas Will.i.am is he's always been focused on digital distribution and media. Let's recall his work with Barack Obama, not with Barack Obama, but with the Barack Obama campaign, and basically distributing videos, getting artists together, coordinating things in order to get a groundswell among the youth. And then Lady Gaga is considered creative avant-garde throughout both the fashion, music, and general entertainment industries. So these people, I think it's on some level, these artists are showing that they're more than artists without rushing to sort of like jump into the movies and become Justin Timberlake. But at the same time, these companies are looking for these new and different voices to add a little, for lack of a better term, pizzazz, or just a vision to what they're doing, aside from the raw business.
It's really interesting that you mentioned Will.i.am, because he also helped BlackBerry. I can't remember what year it was, but I think he helped with the launch of one of their Curve smartphones.
One of the most popular devices they ever created.
Right. The BlackBerry Curve was definitely one of the running spokesmen for it. So,
but can Alicia Keys save BlackBerry, or is it too late for BlackBerry to be saved, even with these new devices? I noticed that they went with both a full touchscreen and the legacy, you know, BlackBerry QWERTY keyboard phones on these. And if you look at the operating system, I mean, it's nothing revolutionary. It's quite similar to, you know, both Windows Phone 8 and iOS in its own way. I don't know. I mean, I think it's at the state where it's kind of at a parity with those devices. And when you're trying to compete and your offering is at a parity with the competitors who are leaps and bounds ahead of you, you have to bring something else to the table to stay afloat. So I'm not sure. I think the only advantage I can see is legacy BlackBerry customers.
Well, I mean, they do have some cool features. I was kind of surprised by a few of the ones that they chose to share.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, one of the ones which I thought was actually kind of interesting was the whole screen share functionality, where you're going BlackBerry to BlackBerry, and during like a video share session, you could share whatever is on the screen on your mobile device and navigate around. In the case you're on a go, you know, two salespeople at a different location quickly share up a presentation so they can see what's associated with it, as well as even, you know, some of the simple things like the story maker or have being able to organize based off of file. And Box actually has an application for BlackBerry already, where one of the ones which are pre-built in the system, which allows you to, you know, share and upload your content and manage it that way without even installing an app. So
I think it's
they
also
have some potential.
Yeah, and there's also – you got to realize there is obviously a move that consumers – have seen in terms of bring your own device. That is a trend. That is something that's working its way to possibly be the de facto way that devices are used for business. The consumer, who also is a professional, brings their own device to the corporate entity in which they work, and the IT department supports that device. That is not the way a lot of businesses want to do their work. And if BlackBerry can present a modern operating system, an operating system that's on par with both Android and iOS and Windows, then, you know, those businesses that have already conformed to BlackBerry, that are BlackBerry focused, BlackBerry native, that like BlackBerry, they have a lot less work suddenly, and they can both offer their talent, their workers, their professionals, the modern devices without having to compromise in terms of the enterprise-focused distributability of the BlackBerry OS, which is why it makes perfect sense that Box, an enterprise-focused, document management, retention, and sharing company, storage, which works, again, focused on the enterprise, would be on this device at the outset. Then you've got your click-cack keyboard situation, the hardware keyboard, and your soft keyboard. You've got different generations of people working. You still got people who love their BlackBerries, and the reason why BlackBerry is okay, is still around today, even though they're failing and they're falling and their stock prices drop, is because so many people continue to use BlackBerry devices faithfully.
Yep.
I mean, we might chide them, we might make fun of them, but they have strong numbers. And the fact that they were fragmented for some time, they were slow to catch up. I mean, we've heard these things about companies like Microsoft before, but Microsoft is still here. And I think that BlackBerry, while younger, not as ancient as Microsoft or whatever, I think that BlackBerry, by reinventing itself in a way that seems to just simply make more sense, frankly. Research in Motion perhaps at one time thought that BlackBerry would be part of what it does. BlackBerry is all it does. So renaming itself BlackBerry, having the brand in sync with what they are, that makes sense. Again, moving toward a person like Alicia Keys to make sure that their direction, their art direction, their creative direction, how they're moving forward is synchronized is the same as Google hiring a new – it's very similar to Google hiring that guy they did for the guy they hired for Jelly Bean to bring soul to the operating system. And not soul like soul music, but that's what he said. He wanted to kind of put a real feeling behind the operating system. These things matter. When you close that iOS device and you hear that click, that's a big part of that sound engineering is a big part of what makes the device seem intuitive. BlackBerry is going to need that if they're going to have to compete. A person like Alicia Keys, who's tied into that kind of thing, is also helpful. You have to also realize that, she's 33 years old. She's got her kid. This is the kind of job that allows her to make an impact in society that's a little different than banging around and making music and kind of being a celebrity. So I think it works out for everybody.
And, you know, one feature which I failed to mention is the BlackBerry's ability, although I haven't seen how they're performing it so far, to, on the same device, have a profile for personal and a profile for work, meaning that there should be, you know, tie-ins to IT departments and methods of managing the software that's on your computer or on your phone and the interaction within them. So that's a lot of the a lot of companies request this and usually have to partner with third-party applications to produce that on devices, and they're trying to incorporate that as a standard. So we'll see how that works out for them.
If they can do it, if they can have some sort of a, let's call it incognito mode for the operating system, so that you can like pop on and do your own thing without affecting or jeopardizing your work and your personal life. That again gets to this idea that you can have one device in your hand instead of all my friends who are bankers who have their BlackBerry in one pocket and their iPhone in another.
Yep. I'm not a big fan of that concept of compartmentalizing so that you have to carry two separate devices.
Like, no one wants to do that.
Yeah. No. I want it all to be in one. But some people like that, and I'm more power
it's
to them.
It's very necessary depending on what your job is. If you work in a more creative field, that's fine. But when you work in a place and, you know, that place is taking up all aspects of your life, and you've really got to realize, and you realize that, you know, you may not be there forever. You might get poached. You might decide to move on to another whatever. Having to extricate all your stuff from your company computer, all your stuff from your company phone, you know, that's not fun. That's a lot of overhead. A lot of people want to be able to get up and walk out of the institution they're working in a moment's notice. Those things are taxed.
Well, we'll have to. Time will tell whether this isn't going to be enough to keep. I was going to say research in motion. Keep BlackBerry afloat, and I guess we'll have to see. Moving on here, Twitter this week introduced Vine, an app that allows you to share 6-second looping videos on the service and in embedded tweets. The app is simple, allowing you to tap the screen to record video and lift your finger to stop. Chaining those clips together allows you to create short, sound-optional movies that can be shared on Twitter. They playback directly inside tweets on Twitter and in its newly expanded embeds. Twitter says that the app is for iOS currently, but will be coming to other platforms. Currently, you're not required to have a Twitter account to use Vine and can sign up via email. Notably, the app also still allows you to share these short videos via Facebook. And I know that part of the other news, which I didn't clip out, but Facebook is increasingly restricting more people from using their graph. So who knows
right.
how
I
long
think Facebook
it'll be.
Usually locks things down. Like most of these services, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they are okay with you pushing your content on their stuff. They're not okay with you pulling their data out of their stuff. Hmm. So I think that this will, like, you'll still be a, you'll still be able to push this onto Facebook. It's just a question of being able to take any metadata, any data surrounding, analytics data surrounding, like, the graph stuff from it. Which is why you can still post your Foursquare stuff onto Facebook, right? Facebook has check-ins, but they don't care as long as your Foursquare is giving them data. Anyone can give them data. They just can't take it away.
Have you tried out Vine?
You know, I first saw it, and I could swear I was looking at a service to make animated GIFs.
It does kind of have that sort of feel with the short length of the clips, plus the fact that you do the little tap thing to sort of start and stop the video. It does have an animated GIF feel.
It's animated GIF feel. And then there's also just this idea that for as long as I've known with Twitter, if I want to put a video up, I could put up 12 seconds, no problem. 12 seconds, a 25-character link to whatever, and I'm really good. Now I get 6 seconds. So I at the outset, I don't really see the big advantage here. I know that a lot of people have been trying to crack the shareable video situation. you've always been able to do it on Twitter, but it's always been sort of clunky between taking the video on iOS and then like trying to update it, whatever. YouTube has gotten a little better at that, but the fact is, it's difficult because you know you've got Viggle, all these other things that are trying to kind of be the Instagram of videos. And the biggest problem with videos that I think people haven't noticed or really acknowledged is that as much as they're funny, if they're not well produced, they come across as home videos. And no one ever watches home videos. I mean, you take a home video, you're on vacation, you take a little video or something, and unless it is massively funny, I'm talking, you know, like it is going to become viral for you. No one's ever going to see that video again. And I think there's a lot of sharing of video that the reason why we have so many wonderful viral videos is in part because so many poor, like, so everyone's just trying to share, and there are a lot of crappy ones out there, and the good ones like cream rise to the top. But I know for me, I'm not going to spend a lot of time taking video of my life and putting it on Twitter so much anymore. It was something I was really doing back in like 2007, 8, 9. But it just never hasn't really ever taken off for me. Or, you know, I see a video on Facebook, I tend to move more toward the pictures anyway. I just don't have time to invest in that.
Yeah,
well it is interesting because it is a small investment, being only 6 seconds. And I think I definitely agree with you. There's going to be a lot of surrounding noise and not too much quality video, but on the other hand, I kind of think to myself, there are times where, you know, I was in Foxborough a few years back for a Inter City Milan versus AC Milan soccer game, and I took a quick snapshot of the intro when, like, the crowd's yelling and everyone's coming out, and it was kind of cool, and it was really short, and, you know, it got that atmosphere over. I don't know if I ever shared it, but this might drive me to maybe post something like that every once in a while. I think it's very niche, but
yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
I mean, Twitter's shown us more than anyone that something that can seem very niche can become very, very popular. Everyone understands what the Facebook model is. I think from 2008 until about 2010, no one had any idea what the Twitter model was, at least not in the mainstream. But Twitter was growing by leaps and bounds anyhow. So I got to give it to them in terms of their ability to understand what people could make use of. So, you know, I'm interested in seeing how it moves.
It's very niche, but it definitely has that hipster appeal, kind of like a video version of Instagram. You know, you just kind of want to do it, and who knows if it'll pick up any sort of velocity and anyone will run with it the way that they have with Instagram. But it's fun to play with.
Right, yeah, and a lot of people are really trying to do that Instagram thing. Guys should check out Gifture and Vidi and a couple other things like that. Because people trying to do that Instagram video thing, and I guess Twitter wants to get in on this.
Absolutely. Why shouldn't they try and corner as many markets as they can before other people do, and use their service to spread the social sharing?
Yeah.
All right, let's move on here. Starting this week, Microsoft will be offering Office as a subscription service for consumers. For $100 a year, Office 365 Home Premium customers can put Office on up to 5 computers, including Macs and Windows 8 tablets, and store up to 27 gigs of data on Microsoft SkyDrive cloud storage service. The subscription includes frequent software updates and allows users to automatically load their customized Microsoft Office settings on each device. Office 365 users will also be able to get Office on Demand, a feature that allows them to temporarily access the latest version of Office on any computer through a web browser, whether or not that device has the program installed. One caveat, once you stop paying, you lose the software. So the question is all of that worth $100 a year? And the bigger question is whether changing the Office business model is going to be worth it for Microsoft.
Hey, this is exactly where everybody wants to go with their software. Microsoft has been talking about this since the year 2000, guys. Since the year 2000. I remember I was sitting in an internship program where I was working, I think, IT or something like that. It was IT. And they were talking about how they wanted to Microsoft had offered to pilot with them this idea of a downloadable subscription focused version of Office, and it was radical at the time. But really, this is the software as a service is what Office needs to be in order to be both fluid when it comes to its usership, in order to stop the piracy, which, you know, Microsoft has always been fighting. And I think it's also really going to help when it comes to support for the product. Just like anything that you download today, they want to be able to say, okay, we're going to update this with the newest software fix, security fix, whatever, and it's really just got to be updated. I don't want to fight with a lot of people. I don't want to have no one clicking on the Microsoft update thing or whatever. I just want it to update, much like how Chrome does in a very seamless way. So I think this is really the next step if they want to continue to make Office viable. Now, obviously, people are going to say, well, I just use Google Docs. Google Docs has it. But if you're a person who's a freelancer or whatever, and you have to use stuff like Excel, Google Docs really doesn't do it. The spreadsheet program isn't as robust. Finally, the idea here is that you can use this product. $100 a year for 5 computers for the full version of Office, that's not bad. Because what happens now is that you go out, people go out to the internet, or they go to, you know, a friend, and they get some cracked version of Office. They have to jump through all these hoops to make sure it doesn't ask to be activated. They install it on one computer. They don't have it on the other computer, or it's not the same, or it hasn't been updated. It's a mess. So I feel like $100 a year, 5 computers, that's your whole family for $100 a year. That's, you know, if you got 3 kids and a spouse, then all of you are on your computers using Microsoft Office, completely updated, completely legitimate for $20 a head. It's not bad.
The way you broke it down there, Dwayne, made me realize that it's really not that bad at all. I don't know. On one level, it feels like being nickeled and dimed. But on the other level, you make a good point about thinking of the overall cost for multiple people with many devices as we've become this, you know, year of or this maybe more so more than 1 year, of course, but like this 5-year period of everyone's got multiple devices that they slam on the table and they work with one another. So it's not bad when you put that into perspective.
Yeah, imagine if you have a small startup and they're, you know, each person has a, you know, 5 computers in the start. You have, like, you know, you're working with 2-3 people. Then your entire, like, Microsoft Office cost is, you know, less money. 27 gigabytes online. I mean, it's an interesting number, 27. Not 30, but 27. But 27 gigabytes of online storage. I think for the Office documents you're making, that's more than enough. You know, for your Office. Especially, and if you've got something like, what I want to see is, do they allow me to save this stuff on Box? Do they allow me to save this stuff on Dropbox? Do they allow me to save this stuff on any place I want to save it? Or am I locked into Microsoft's cloud? You know,
that's the big question. I think if you're already paying a subscription for Microsoft Office 365, you can export those documents into whatever sort of format or whatever sort of system that you want to. I think the SkyDrive isn't just a convenience, an option. But you know what really kind of breaks my heart about this is that it's just another confirmation that all of these companies are going from the pay once, use it forever model to getting you on a subscription model, which,
yep.
I just hate. I don't want to be on all of these subscriptions.
No, you're right. The idea that there's a constant thing that's just sucking out of my bank account every month or whatever,
yeah,
is a problem. That's a problem, right? Like, there, you have to have a compelling product or service in order for me to want to do that. One example of that could be, you know, Netflix. It's like paying for cable, but it's better for me because I don't care if the show just came out or not. I just want it all, and I don't want the commercials. So that really works well for me. There's certain things you need, like utilities, like, you know, your cable modem or your DSL, your internet connection, whatever, your cell phone, all those things. But, you know, in the end, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are paying for things like Evernote. They're paying $50 a year for Evernote, right? Mm-hmm. They're paying $38 a year for Pandora, or $36 a year for Pandora, or if you buy it through iTunes, you have to pay $48 a year. So people are spending money on some of these luxury items. like, you know, Netflix, Pandora, Evernote. You know, these are bits of software. $12 a year for Instapaper with the searchability.
Right.
So if you look at it, I mean, the cost of Office is, if you're going to use Office, and I think that a big part of Microsoft's problem is that a lot of people are like, I just don't need Office anymore. I just don't need it. I am not an Excel monkey. PowerPoint isn't necessary. You know, like if you're an Apple person, you can spend, you know, what is Office? Office is Microsoft Word, Microsoft PowerPoint, Microsoft Excel, Microsoft Outlook, right?
Yeah, and maybe a couple of other minor
Access.
If you're really focused, I'm not sure if you're going to get access with this particular version of Office that you're getting. I know the home version of Office includes these four things, and access is usually something that's on like a more pro or business situation, Office Enterprise, etc. What I'm saying is that if you're an Apple person, you're spending $15 on each of those things. You're spending $15 on the first three. Mail and calendar are free. So there's that. And as consumers move quickly to the Apple platform, the Macintosh platform, you're set that way too. So I think Microsoft is trying to maintain relevance. And if you're, it's just like Vim, right? Like Andy asked the question, like, I don't know, this kind of seems like they're just catching up to where other people are. I think on some level, Microsoft is doing the same thing. They're trying to like take their model and pivot it. But the fact is the new models are kind of too efficient for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be a little, so like when you hear this number, $100 a year, you're kind of like, eh. Now you do the breakdown, you lay it out, $100 a year isn't that big of a deal when you compare it to so many other services that people use, but it's still not a comfortable number. It's not a slam dunk. It's not a number that you say, like when I spend $36 a year in Pandora because I don't like to be stopped listening to commercials. I don't want to like, and I don't want to have to think about how many times I've played a particular song. That $36 a year for me is a no-brainer, unlimited bandwidth. The $16 a month I pay for Netflix is a no-brainer. I use it all the time. With Office, I think people are like, that's not a no-brainer. It's $100 a month, a year.
Yeah,
that's like, $8 a month, kind of. Yeah, I don't know. Google's pretty good.
I don't even know if it's efficient for enterprise because, you know, I work at a company where they have bought everybody a seat license for Microsoft Office, but they also don't update it with every version of Microsoft Office. I'm like working with a version of Microsoft Office that's a few years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they went with this 365 subscription model, they would have to pay for every single seat license on a yearly basis.
They would get a big discount, I think. If you're working with a company, if you're working with a big, big, big company that's got a lot of people, you're not paying $100 a year per person. You're probably paying more like $60 a year per license, but not all the licenses get active at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you have a pool of licenses, kind of like DHCP.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how that's distributed. So, you know, when you fire it up, it calls for a license, and it's unlikely that they're going to be out there. They have one license for every single person. They probably have a license for 80% of the people. So they've got a discount that way. And then there's just the idea that now the IT staff doesn't have to worry about supporting different versions of Office, which, I mean, Tosin, you're focused on IT. I feel like that's a lot of time suck. That's money right there, having to wonder, oh, this version of Office doesn't support this. Oh, this version of Office is only 32-bit. This other one is only 64-bit. This one doesn't have Access. This one does. This one is 2012. This one doesn't have the ribbon. This one has the new ribbon. I don't know. I feel like that's a lot of overhead.
All right, let's move on here. Speaking of paid subscriptions, YouTube is allegedly preparing to launch paid subscriptions for individual channels on its video platform. In its latest attempt to lure content producers, eyeballs, and advertiser dollars away from traditional TV, according to multiple people familiar with the plans, YouTube has reached out to a small group of channel producers and asked them to submit applications to create channels that users would have to pay to access. As of now, it appears that the first paid channels will cost anywhere between $1 and $5 a month. In addition to episodic content, YouTube is also considering charging for content libraries and access to live events a la pay-per-view, as well as self-help or financial advice shows. It's not clear which channels will be part of the first paid subscription rollout, but it's believed that YouTube will lean on the media companies that have already shown the ability to develop large followings on the video platform, including networks like Machinima, Maker Studios, and Fullscreen. YouTube is also looking outside its current roster of partners for candidates. These people said that YouTube could introduce these paid channels as early as the second quarter of this year. So everyone's looking to make money here.
Thank God.
Well, it's great for YouTube producers, content producers. Absolutely, I think.
Well, it's great for YouTube. I mean, like, I don't know. I just feel like these, like, we're so used to, and it's all, people are so used to, like, getting all this stuff for free. I'm excited they're going to, like, that people, like, you know, these companies don't just make money out of nowhere. YouTube can't continue, like, be subsidized completely off of Google's, you know, search moneymaker. And, you know, YouTube came out, it got some money off of advertising. It was making that money a lot, like, in large part off of Paramount, Viacom content. They'd get little bits of the Jon Stewart show or the Stephen Colbert show or the Man show or whatever, and people would play those clips over and over and over because they were funny, and then YouTube advertising would be there. That's not an honest way to make money, right? So I think this original content stuff these new media companies are doing, they're going to do a lot for us, Andy. They're going to make it so that the traditional media companies are forced to continue to work on TV everywhere, you know, straight up TV on your devices. They're going to have to become more efficient, more lean, less in the way of, you know, the 15 to 20 minutes of commercials per hour of TV, and more in the way of just, like, good content that's magnetic, that gets people there with a sponsor in the middle. Think anime back in the 90s, right? Like that kind of style. And then you've got, like, you know, Netflix is pioneering this with their five separate, you know, the one show's already on the air, and they've got like four more on the way, and they're just on Netflix, right? And you're already paying for everything else on Netflix. The fact that Google's going to do this with the studios that have already made content that people really enjoy,
yeah,
that sounds like, it just sounds like a win-win for everybody. So yeah, it might cost you $15 a month for YouTube Premium or whatever, but the freemium model, this idea that you get some stuff for free and you pay more for some other stuff, that is a way that the consumer sees value almost immediately.
Sure.
Yeah, totally agree here. It's definitely great for those artists. I know, you know, there are probably going to be quite a lot of people who will be outraged that there is some sort of charge, but I think these places will still make a decent amount of revenue from it. And I think a lot of people will be understanding that, you know, these are also artists. Same thing like musicians who release their CDs, and this is a method of getting them some revenue. And if it's quality content, people will be willing to pay for it.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's another thing. Like, you mentioned the artists, and I think that's really important because we have this image. And I know, like, you know, Tosin and I, you know, Chris and Avenger, we all went to this, like, you know, East Coast liberal school where there's all these people who are starving artists, right? It's like, oh, I'm a starving artist. And then some of you are like, man, I can't afford to do that. They should get a real job. That's what everyone says. Why don't you get a real job? Have something to fall back on, right? And then the minute their art requires money or, you know, starts making money, then they get blamed for being sellouts. And I feel like the only way to, like, move away from that paradigm is with this, like, freemium model. Like, you know, it happens on iTunes too. You can find the pilot for a TV show for free, and then you can pay for the season. That makes sense. The idea is that, yeah, if you like it, then show me that you like it, support it, pay for it. If more shows or networks were focused this way, Firefly might still be on the air, or just have wound down in like the year 2008 or whatever, instead of like having 1 year. But the idea that, like, you're an artist, you're like Pamplemousse, those guys who do the funny covers and make their own music. You know, like, they were doing it on their own. Everyone was like, oh, so cool. And then, like, you know, Hyundai picked them up. Oh, you guys sold out. That's nonsense. That's nonsense. And that's the thing that I think YouTube is capable of doing. YouTube is one of the few services that feels like, yeah, there are commercials on it, but you can skip them. Yeah, there's random stuff that people made up. It really is like a place where people get to express themselves. And the idea that you're going to, you know, drop a little change to see the new hotness, the Vimeo quality stuff, so to speak, in terms of like super professionally focused and all that kind of stuff, they're going to bring that to light. YouTube is going to, the brand itself is going to change significantly, because as much as that homemade viral video is going to be there, that stuff that you usually associate with Vimeo, the super high quality, high produced, well thought out content, that's going to be on YouTube, and people are going to be like, I can pay for that. And I think that's going to be exciting.
I want to take this opportunity, as long as we're talking about this, to plug that show that I mentioned a few shows back, H Plus, the digital series, which is produced by Bryan Singer, who directed the X-Men movies. This is one of those shows that I would actually pay for. They just finished their first season, and I was incredibly impressed at the production the value of the show itself. I felt this is one of the few instances where I felt like I was almost cheating YouTube for getting this for free, because it's something that I would probably have paid for.
And Disney put up a short video today on YouTube. I forgot what it was called, but basically it's a really well produced short movie, and it's gorgeous, and it was all over like Facebook.
Played before Wreck-It Ralph, I think.
Yeah, played before Wreck-It Ralph.
Oh, I know that short. That's a beautiful short.
Right. So the idea is that like YouTube is really going to become a source,
mm-hmm.
and if they do it correctly, it's not going to get in the way of the amateur created content. But it is going to force everybody in the space to think about new ways of distributing content, all good content, whether it's amateur or not. I still think people are going to be able to, like, the best part about YouTube is right now the three of us can, you know, get in front of a couple cameras, make up some show, do like 6 episodes of it all on our own dime, and have anybody in the world look at it. I don't think that's going to go away. All they're saying now is that there's going to be an opportunity for you to see some stuff that is more highly produced, and that's going to be good.
All right, let's take a break here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called Warm Bodies by Isaac Marion. It's a romantic zombie comedy novel. Has recently been adapted into a movie, which is out on Friday, which is probably when this episode is going to be released. So you should be able to see the movie when you hear this podcast. But if you're interested in reading the book that it's based on, it's on Audible now. It's about a young man with an existential crisis. He's a zombie. After experiencing a teenage boy's memories while consuming his brain, he begins a tense, awkward, and strangely sweet relationship with the victim's human girlfriend. His choice to protect her will transform not only himself, but his fellow dead, and perhaps their whole lifeless world. Scary, funny, and surprisingly poignant, Warm Bodies explores what happens when the cold heart of a zombie is tempted by the warmth of human love. And that book, or any of Audible's other 10,000-plus titles, can be yours for free, as well as a 30-day trial to check out their service. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. And going to that website helps the Drill Down out, helps our show out. So if you're not already an Audible subscriber, subscribe via that URL, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, and it helps us out on the show. All right, we're going to... Dwayne just made me laugh. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music, but when we return, did the first Steve Jobs biopic get it right? Will J.J. Abrams unite the Geekiverse or divide it? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Onufwewakin. And let's talk about Apple here. Apple this week announced a 128 gig version of the fourth generation iPad with Retina display.
Yeah! keep on releasing new shit.
Apple will make both Wi-Fi only and cellular options for the new 128 gig capacity fourth generation iPad, and confirmed that they'll have both black and white models of the device, and it would be available starting February 5th through Apple's online store, retail locations, and authorized resellers. I feel like this is
a new iPad.
That why like didn't it feels like they're really sort of diluting their product line. Didn't they used to save up these announcements, save up these upgrades for...
Yes and no. I mean, this is... I mean, okay, let's look at this really, really objectively. All right. Just look straight at the data. So what you have here is if you buy a 64 gigabyte Wi-Fi 3G iPad, you're going to spend $829. If you buy a 128 gigabyte 3G iPad, you're going to spend $929. It's a really incremental movement. If they decide that in April and May they want to come out with the iPad 5, I would totally agree with you, because they popped out the iPad 3 in April, May of 2012. They popped out the iPad 4 in like October of 2012. So there was no time there, right? You couldn't digest the change. It didn't have its whole year or whatever. But this is more – it's not even like if the iPad 4 was an incremental upgrade. This is just – adding to a line. They're not calling it the iPad 5. They're not giving it any kind of special name or whatever. They're just saying that it's available in a new capacity. And I think if you look at the way they have economies of scale, it's not like necessarily like a, oh, I have to run out and get the new one kind of thing. It's available for those people who might want it. And they've talked about how it's focused on a business perspective where, you know, large images like x-rays and so on would be useful. I think it's probably more useful for consumers right now who want to replace their laptops or their netbooks or whatever tiny small computers they've got with a computer that can hold everything they want to hold in it. But I don't think that this isn't the dilution that I feel like we've been pained about with Apple before. But I am still a little shocked that it was released so unceremoniously.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, they're not really adding too much, though. On one hand, it is Retina, but on the other hand, it's just, I don't know, it feels like we were already expecting it. And there's no, it's only one item for a large overall project, and mm-hmm. I think they're waiting to have a series of changes to announce a new product.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the market share for this is as large as anything else for the other, you know, iPads or minis.
Yeah, I think you're right. I also feel as if they wanted to remove the 16 gigabyte version and only drop 32, 64, and 128, that would make a bit more sense to me. But it seems like the memory might cost too much for them to want to do that right now. But in terms of PR, I think Andy's got a point. I just feel like I was worried that we were going to see a fifth generation iPad with an A7 or an A6X processor and a whole bunch of new bells and whistles that was released for Valentine's Day. and that isn't the case. It's just sort of like 128. Let's get 128 in there. It's in the mix. You know, there's an iPad for everybody now. But this is part of their problem, right? Like there's an iPad for not everybody, but there's like an iPad in every single niche of the situation. So you're kind of, there's a little bit of confusion now. What do you want when you get an iPad? It used to be like, I got the iPad. Does it have 3G or not? Is it small, medium, or large? Now it's small, medium, extra large. You know, so too many choices. You'll end up with like looking at a Dell product line or an HP product line where you just don't know what to get.
All right, moving on here. The first clip from the independent film Jobs, starring Ashton Kutcher as Steve Jobs, was released online last week. The brief clip shows Kutcher as Jobs speaking with Josh Gad in the role of Steve Wozniak. Let me just play this clip because it's a very short clip for you, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
It's the Industrial Revolution. No more decks. No more mainframes. That changes everything.
It's pretty cool, I guess. Like,
cool.
Hello.
It's profound. How could you not tell me about this before?
No, I was just working on it for my own. It was a
exactly, hobby. Exactly. For your own. For you. It's what you wanted. It's what your gut and your instinct wanted. Your big, evolved brain wanted something that didn't exist, and so you just willed it into existence. What do you call the system?
The operating system.
The operating system.
That's what I call it. Yeah, it's just a real-time display of current operations.
You can see what you're working on while you're working on it.
Okay.
Don't you get this? This is freedom. This is freedom to create and to do and to build and as artists, as individuals.
But look, you're overreacting. Even if you were developing this for freaks like us, and I doubt you are, nobody wants to buy a computer. Nobody.
How does somebody know what they want if they've never even seen it?
So Steve Wozniak said of that scene that it's quote, not close. We never had such interaction in roles. I'm not even sure what it's getting at. Personalities are very wrong. He says, don't forget that my purpose was inspired by the values of the Homebrew Computer Club, along with the ideas of the value of such machines. And Jobs wasn't around and didn't attend the club, so he was the one learning about such social impact of the future. So, in fact, it was precisely the contrary. His idea was to make a $20 PC board and sell it for $40 to help people at the club build the computer I'd given away. Steve came from selling surface parts, and he said he always saw a way to make a quick buck off my designs, and the lofty talk came much further down the line. A review from Casey Newton at CNET says that basically his disappointment with the movie was that it felt very shallow, and Jobs did... you know, in the early days, he did have to his coworkers had to wrestle with a man who smelled bad, who cried often, who yelled constantly, who missed deadlines and overspent his budget by millions. But he did it in service of the products we love and use daily. And his obsessions took a toll on those around him. There's great drama to be found in all that, but it's not to be found in the saccharine Jobs adaptation here. And this is not the one that's going to be based on Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs. That's the one that's going to be written by Aaron Sorkin and to be directed. Is it David Fincher who's directing that one as well? I can't remember.
Pretty sure it is, yeah. With consultation by Woz.
Yes. So I cannot wait to see that one. This one, I'm really curious about. I mean, what really, the only thing that sort of excites me about seeing a clip like this is that it's seeing a moment in history dramatized that I was actually alive for and remember, you know, vividly being a part of. So I, you know, something like this is a sort of a cultural landmark for me that I can completely relate to, and it's fun just from a pure visceral level to see it being portrayed as a historical document. But otherwise, I mean, I don't know how much it sounds like they totally like glorified Steve Jobs's role here.
I think that in some of these films, like, you know, there's going to be the official one. This is clearly the unofficial one. And I think this kind of goes toward the image more than the man. And that's what that clip at least seems to be advertising. The image of this guy who saw it before everybody else saw it, who just felt it and who got it in a way that, like, we get it today. And how come people didn't get it that way? Because that's how we all think. But if you think about it, he made us all think that way, that kind of thing. And I think that's kind of where the Ashton Kutcher situation, this production of dramatization of this man's life is really focused on. I mean, obviously, there's going to be a lot of dramatization built into whatever Sorkin writes. But the idea here is that what they're trying to convey is kind of all about Jobs, not about the mundane nature of moving the world forward, mm-hmm. which doesn't always have these great moments of lucid stream of consciousness inspiration, you know? So it's kind of what we're seeing.
Right. I think my main issue with this depiction is, purely from an acting perspective, it just seems so forced, so bad, at least from this clip. You know, that doesn't tell the tale of the entire film. And like one of the comments on the article that she'll be sharing, it looks and sounds like Ashton Kutcher in the role of Ashton Kutcher. Like, I totally got that feel. And the character, the actor playing Waz, that's all I can say. So, you know, I'm okay with dramatizations. Like, we had that with the Facebook movie, right? There are a lot of aspects to that weren't true, and that put them in a different light. But on one hand, you know, it'll be great to actually see the film that shows us the real life facts, or to a more true perspective. On the other hand, I am okay with something that is more fictionalized, as long as it's good. And from what I've seen so far, it doesn't seem very good.
I'm even okay with I'm okay with artistic license, and certainly the Social Network movie had took a lot of artistic license. But I think beyond that artistic license, what Aaron Sorkin's screenplay and based on the Ben Mezrich novel showed was the core sort of dramatic truths that superseded even the historical facts. It was essentially a dramatized story to reveal the dramatic truths of human nature in greed and power struggles that just so happened to real live people. And even if Aaron Sorkin does that with the Walter Jacobson's biography, I'd be okay with that, as long as he gets to the heart of the truths of human nature somewhere in there, even if it's a little fast and loose with Steve Jobs's. I've read the book, so I know the truth portrayed in that book, in that biography.
Let's remember that Isaacson's book is an official biography insofar as he's working with the subject of the biography to denote it. Although he's doing that, in doing that, he exposes himself to some bias, so to speak. The Facebook movie that you're referring to was written based on a book called The Accidents of Billionaires, which was done on the type of research that you'd find in an encyclopedia. Secondary sources, some primary sources, but mostly secondary sources, in order to put together a story that's based on the consensus of multiple individuals rather than dealing directly with Mark Zuckerberg or whatever.
Sure.
So they're fundamentally two different historiographies. And this particular and the thing that made the Social Network so powerful wasn't just Sorkin's writing. I mean, I think I'm glad that we're in a place now where you can look at a video, at a movie, at a play, and be impressed by the actual writing. Because it used to be that you only gave kudos to the actors. And I think in The Social Network particularly, the actors did a phenomenal job of portraying the director's vision and the writer's vision of what went down. Ashton Kutcher, unfortunately, has never come across as a fine dramatic actor schooled in the method. Well, I mean, Tosin said, I think it's bad, and I don't know what bad means. I don't know what that means in terms of like, oh, something's amazing, something's bad, whatever. I do know that Ashton Kutcher is not schooled in, you know, the method way of fine dramatic acting, and that comes across in that clip, and it comes across and multiple things that he's done. I mean, he's known for his TV show Punk'd. And if he can get out, or like That 70s Show, which is a comedy, and if he can get out of that, then kudos to him. But I think the people who want to go see this film are going to be in some ways people who don't know any better. Oh, it's about Steve Jobs. That's cool. I'll watch it. They're going to be people who don't, you know, who are just like Jobs fans. They want to suck in everything they can of him. And they're people who are going to say, well, you know, I just want to see... I'm curious to see what this is about because I've heard so many things about this because it has Ashton Kutcher in it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I don't think that this film will be, especially in the shadow of the Isaacson-based film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it'll be that big. But then again, all last year we were saying that, you know, they're going to be two big comic book movies and the Batman was going to destroy the Avengers, and that didn't happen either.
No.
What I do know is that I'm interested to see what Kutcher's motivations are, how he portrays it. And it's good to at least see that they're not trying to be the Isaacson novel. This is kind of, it's not quite Deep Impact versus Armageddon, you know?
Right. I like that reference.
I think by bad, I mean, like, terrible. No. I mean, like, the interaction is so forced, and, like, it's kind of like, oh, here's the really nerdy guy versus here's the more hip individual. And it's just like, is that really what interactions were like, or what people think interactions were like?
Well, was Steve Jobs ever really hip? I mean, the man wore black turtleneck and you know, grandpa jeans for the duration of his, like, adulthood.
Yeah.
Like, the idea that, like, he's hip is I don't know. I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, like, if I was Woz, I would not be. I would not enjoy the characterization that I am portrayed as in this clip.
Have you guys ever watched 30 Rock?
Yes. Yes.
Jenna Maroney once did an unofficial biography of Janis Joplin.
Oh, yeah.
But they didn't have any rights to anything.
Right.
So they had to change all the names. And I kind of felt like the same level of Oprah acting that she did when she sold sheets of that is how I heard Ashton Kutcher in that film right there.
Ouch.
The biography of, like, Steve Jobs,
right.
And it's like Steve Wozniak, you know, like it's going to be all these different names because they just don't, it's just not there. So I don't know.
All right. I've saved the best news here for last. And this is the one that has been rocking the, it's the one that it's the most divisive, I think.
Rock the geek world.
Yes. So Disney last Friday night announced that J.J. Abrams will be directing Star Wars Episode 7, the latest film in the franchise, and the first since Disney bought Lucasfilm last October. Lucasfilm President Kathleen Kennedy said, J.J. is the perfect director to helm this. Beyond having such great instincts as a filmmaker, he has an intuitive understanding of the franchise. He understands the essence of the Star Wars experience and will bring that talent to create an unforgettable motion picture. George Lucas said, I've consistently been impressed with JJ as a filmmaker and a storyteller. He's the ideal choice to direct the new Star Wars film, and the legacy couldn't be in better hands. Now, you know, the Geekosphere was up in arms about this because JJ Abrams, as most people realize, recently rebooted the Star Trek franchise to great success.
Heresy!
and now he's always said, even when he was beginning production on the Star Trek reboot, that he was never a big Star Trek fan. He's always been a big Star Wars fan, and I think his Star Trek reboot was kind of a way to act out his dreams of directing a space opera. Yes, but do it on Star Trek instead of Star Wars. So he kind of made Star Trek his own Star Wars, and then he
made the Vulcan emotional. What kind of jerk is he?
But now he got the call to make Star Wars. This is his literally his dream come true. What do you guys think about this?
Okay, first of all, the CEO of Coke cannot be the CEO of Pepsi.
Why not?
It's called a conflict of interest. You have to have your situations, like, you know, in nice separate little buckets. Star Wars has long been the pinnacle of sci fantasy. That's what.
Well,
it
hold on. Very hold on. Quickly. Let me interject.
I want you to interject. I just want to say one last thing. Right. I define what Star Wars was. I'm going to define what Star Trek is. Star Trek is a somewhat mundane but optimistic view of the future, where, you know, lots of different people can live together, where we don't, it's where the paradigm of the Cold War is broken asunder by the individual's need and want to live together in a peaceful, harmonious way and move things forward. They're fundamentally different. And I don't say that J.J. Abrams doesn't have the capacity for those to work with those nuances. But given that he forgot the essence of Gene Roddenberry's vision for Star Trek and his quote unquote reboot, I don't know I shudder to think, rather, what we'll see out of his Star Wars piece.
But you know what? He wasn't given the task of staying faithful to Roddenberry. He was given the task of making Star Trek profitable and cool. And you can't argue that that's what it is.
I think that when you look at what Roddenberry did, everything he did about Star Trek made it profitable and cool. The only time Star Trek wasn't profitable and cool is when they got away from Gene Roddenberry. And when J.J. Abrams took that 50-year tradition and decided to cast it aside with a sun exploding, sun exploded and then cast it aside 50 years of cinematic, like, you know, of a humongous universe, of an amazing franchise that is frankly far more vast than Star Wars has ever been, in terms of content. I thought it was a slap in the face to many of the characters, and I think it was a slap in the face mostly because he forgot the fundamentals that made Star Trek so interesting in an attempt to get a cheap thrill. And that's what I feel like he did.
I think to a certain extent, and to a certain extent, throughout the entire process, J.J. Abrams has said, I'm a big Star Wars fan.
Sure.
Not necessarily Star Trek. I'm actually not even sure his connection to that, to the show or the films in general. So I think it's kind of your analogy of being the owner of Coke and or, you know, a head of Coke, also the head of Pepsi is a little incorrect, because it would be more so the head of Coke saying, hey, I really, really like Pepsi, although I'm working on at Coke right now.
Oh, so, dude, but if you think about it, this is what happens. If you're the head of Coke and you really, really like Pepsi, but you're the head of Coke, then what you're doing, you have a conflict of interest insofar as you can't be true to Coke because you like Pepsi. It's almost as if you were the chancellor of some great empire, and
yet
you had one of your lackeys put together a rebellion against your empire that you were in charge of anyhow.
No, I disagree.
You suddenly won on both sides of that argument. You won on both sides, and you were able to destroy them both.
I think as long as Abrams keeps both worlds separate, and
he's Palpatine, dude.
Tell us how you really feel.
As long as he doesn't incorporate Star Trek into Star Wars and vice versa, I think we're okay. You know,
hey, you see my issue with Abrams on Star Wars and Star Trek, right? The conflict of interest.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're talking about a theoretical conflict of interest.
Oh no, that's a real conflict of interest. Type up Star Wars Star Trek rivalry. I mean, that's his thing.
You know what? I'll link to there was another great sort of article not great, but I mean really interesting read by I can't remember what movie site, but basically he was butthurt that J.J. Abrams jumped ship from Star Trek just after he made it cool to leave to go to Star Wars.
He jumped ship? He's making a second Star Trek movie.
Sure, but who knows how deep his involvement's going to be after that point.
I mean, that's J.J. Abrams, right? Like, J.J. Abrams doesn't like to stay in one place for too long. That's why we have the problems that we had with Alias and Lost and all those other things, you know?
As a producer, definitely. He's a show starter and lever.
Disney already got Whedon to direct, I guess it was Sony that got Whedon to direct the Avengers, but like, could you imagine what you could do with Star Wars type characters with Joss Whedon, who's already directed Han Solo if the war had been lost? That's my theory.
Well, I mean, a lot of people.
That's my theory.
A lot of people say that that J.J. Abrams essentially made Star Trek, his version of Star Trek, into Star Wars.
Right.
So, say that again?
Like, his version of Star Trek is essentially Star Wars.
Yeah, there is some of that, which is kind of why, again, it's whack that he was able to get into there in the first place.
Because he didn't think he was...
Joss Whedon. Like, look at the facts. This is, like, my overriding theory of the universe. Joss Whedon figured out a child hero in the... Like, when he was younger, this idea of, like, a blonde kid who had to save the world, right? That is Luke, but it is Buffy. And then he's like, okay, I'm done with that. Let's explore what happens with the other character, Han Solo. What if the war had been lost? And that's what Firefly is. That's all it is, except for Inara's in there. And I guess she's a companion, so she's kind of like a little royalty kind of person, but they have all these issues, and I really didn't like her. But other than that, it's really what happened. If the war had been lost and Han Solo wore a brown coat, that's Mal. That's what Firefly was. And that's why Joss Whedon would be perfect for Star Wars.
Oh, sure. And maybe in another episode. You know, they're already talking about perhaps him for one of the non-Skywalker saga Star Wars films.
I know Ron Moore was tapped by George Lucas for a live-action Star Wars TV show.
It was probably that the Jedi Academy one that they had.
Yeah, it was Jedi Academy. Ron Moore and Lucas were working on that. All these things, they get tied up because Moore had to kind of like – he wasn't paying attention to Battlestar Galactica for that season, which is why Battlestar Galactica season 3 was so painful. But he got back on the horse for season 4 and all that stuff got taken care of. But in the end, you know, like Lucas decided that, you know, he couldn't get what he needed to do it, whatever. But now with the selling of the franchise, the selling of the property to Disney, you know, it's unclear whether that's going to get resurrected or not. Sure. I think what is clear is that Disney is a good custodian of what I think we can really refer to as cultural cinematic treasures. Right. Star Wars isn't just about, oh, it's Star Wars, it's kind of goofy, it's geeky, whatever. It's a cultural treasure. It's not even a modern classic anymore because it's 30 years old. But I think it's a property that's a cultural treasure. Just like I think comic books are cultural treasures, like the X-Men and all that shit. So I feel like Disney can handle it, but I really feel like it's a question of finding the right people. Like what Warner Brothers did with Nolan.
Yeah.
Batman is a cultural treasure, and he made it finite and ephemeral. He's like 3 episodes. That's it. We're done. Walking away now. And I mean, that's the mentality that we have to begin to take to some of these properties. And I know some business people might say, no, we just got to squeeze as much money out of it as possible. But we've seen where that road is. We've seen how that road goes down. You get Michael Bay and Transformers with that kind of road. Right? And that's not what we want. I mean, like, think about it. That's really what you get. I can think of 4 properties that touch the super early millennials like me. The guys born in like 1980, the very first millennials. There are 4 properties that we really resonate with. Thundercats, Transformers, Star Wars, Star Trek. Those are the big 4.
Thundercats. Right?
I love how you include Thundercats.
No, I'm saying like if you had to like it's a question of your formative years. Thundercats was a big deal if you were born in like 1980 and you were watching like TV in like 1985, 1986. It wasn't that it was great. It was just really part of that formative year experience. Actually, you could probably remove Thundercats and throw in G.I. Joe or He-Man. G.I. Joe was destroyed by the same hubris that was applied to the Thundercats, right? I mean, applied to the Transformers. Like, those two properties are almost forever destroyed unless you can find the next generation of Christopher Nolan to bring them back and make them, like, normal again.
To me, this feels like an embarrassment of riches because I've been a huge fan of J.J. Abrams' work for the most part. And I think, really, maybe his only real misstep has been his own the content that he created himself, Super 8, which was, I think is flawed, but a terrific attempt at, sort of, a Spielbergian, sci-fi thriller. But otherwise pretty much everything he's done, I think he's been a great steward of the, Star Trek franchise, a great steward of, Mission Impossible. And of course, he's been arguably successful in the series that he's launched also. And
are
I love
you kidding.
No, right. Absolutely
Lost, a completely terrible TV show after season one.
No.
You get to Alias, a completely terrible TV show after season one.
Well, after season two, I'll argue with you.
Okay,
on
your standards
Alias.
Are a little lower than mine. Fine. Wow, but the bottom line is that he rolls out. I'm not trying to diss your taste. I'm saying my standard for like knowing where a TV show is going to go has not been something that he's been very good at. He starts it and then he kind of walks away from it. But I feel like what we see with the films is that, yes, it's a finite thing and he's got to be there for the whole 2 hours. So we see some stuff get put together. And I would say that with the exception of Super 8, his films have been compelling. I won't begrudge you that. I think that you're right on time there. But I think that a big piece of it is that he may be, because of the series aspect, the film is kind of hybrid, right? Because Star Wars and Star Trek are series. And if he's going to be involved in it, I need to feel the confidence that he's going to be involved in the series 100% throughout at least a significant chunk of it, a trilogy. Not like I'm going to be there for the first one and then I'm going to back out and focus on something else for the next couple, you know? And that's what the series that he's worked on have – that's where they've had the most trouble. Because he hasn't been able to be consistent. He hasn't been able to flesh out where the series begins, what's the middle, and what the end is. He thinks of the beginning and a premise, and then his writers kind of don't know what's going on for seasons 2, 3, and 4, and then if the show's still around,
arguably on the series end, yes. But I think
that's what these are. These are trilogies.
Okay, but
these are series.
Yeah, yes. But I think individually, if you take the movie, the feature films separately, I think he's done quite well.
Which feature films are you talking about?
I definitely
Mission
think
Impossible,
so.
I think that we've seen, two Abrams films now?
Well, Abrams produced the Ghost Protocol, but he directed the
third one,
yeah.
Right, so he's been involved in like two of them, and I'm happy to see that he's been consistent. But again, there's a hybrid between TV series and movies when you're taking on what I think is a cultural treasure like Star Wars or Star Trek, and these are serials. They're still series.
Sure.
They're and in order for them to have a cohesive new trilogy, I think what we need to see is Abrams, maybe if a contract said, look, you're going to make 3 Star Wars movies for us, that would give me more confidence, as opposed to him showing up, making the first one, walking away, and leaving no direction for the people who come after him. And then you don't end up with an Empire Strikes Back, you end up with an Attack of the Clones. Nobody wants that again.
Well, we can't judge him on what... We can only judge him on what he does, so we'll have to judge him on the film that he delivers, not necessarily on the legacy that film will have for future films. That's up to future directors.
No. You gotta commit, man. It's like when you're snowboarding, you gotta go toe side or heel side. You can't stay in the middle, or else you're gonna fall.
But you're still judging before you've seen the final product.
I'm judging based on what I know of his previous work, which I think is very valid. He hasn't committed. He hasn't committed to actually completing.
I think he's done great previous.
If Devendra was here, oh man. I definitely think this is a great choice and opportunity.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you really think about it, we could only go up at this point, right?
Star Wars?
In the Star Wars legacy, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
you mean following the prequel trilogy is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I disagree. It could go up, but there are also, I mean, if you think about some of the other people who are out there, I think you've got people like Josh Whedon, who knows Star Wars like the back of his hand, who did his own space opera, you know. And like I've said before, his space opera is basically what if Han Solo had survived and the rebellion had lost. And he does a wonderful job with that. He understands these characters that aren't part of, you know, a military structure, that are running around and trying to figure things out and do whatever. So there's Joss Whedon. There's also people like Christopher Nolan, who definitely not the same, but very good at taking something that may have been camped up, like the prequel trilogy, and toning it back down into a place where adults can recognize the characters and commiserate with them and allow the series to move forward and gain its former gravitas and glory. He took the cultural treasure of Batman and he saved it from the legacy of Batman and Robin, and he brought it back. I think there are people like Christopher Nolan who can add a wonderful psychological and emotional and spiritual aspect to pieces of the series themes like the Force and explore those ritualistically. Whereas with J.J. Abrams, I can only say that when I look at Lost or when I look at Mission Impossible, I'm not seeing the deep-seated themes that make a legendary cultural treasure. They're fun movies. They have a certain amount of a thrill and excitement. But when it comes down to it, what was the ghost? Why did Mr. Echo die? Who's Bianchini or whatever this Da Vinci slash Nostradamus?
First of all,
you never figure it out because he doesn't actually create one of the focuses of fiction, which is a foundation that sets the rules up for and helps to foreshadow for what will happen later, and then allows the user to come to conclusions on their own instead of having the characters and the plot force down choices on top of them that don't seem to make sense and are full of more twists than they are actual revelations. That's one of the problems that I have with J.J. Abrams. If you want me to break out the whole Duane DeFreitas, English major, Amherst colleagues, like, let's break down what happens in these stories. That's the biggest problem with Abrams.
I think if you're using Lost as an example, you're completely way off base. I think you're focusing on the
Lost was his most successful venture.
Sure. But I think you're focusing on the details of the plot as opposed to what Lost really delivered, which were these
thrills.
No, these deeply dimensional portrayals of these characters, buttressed by the plot. Now, whatever you think of the actual sort of mythology of the series is neither here nor there. Like, what the strengths of Lost were in the portrayals of the characters, and I think if he brings that sensibility to Star Wars the way he brought it also to Star Trek, I think we're going to have a winning beginning of a reboot.
See, when it comes to what he did with Star Trek, there were two characters that I saw come through as actually like true and interesting, not cardboard cutout characters. I saw Kirk as Jack from Lost. I saw Uhura as Sydney whatever from Alias. I saw those cardboard cutouts immediately. I saw what's his name, Spock as suddenly emotional, even though the whole point of him is to be a straight man and counterfoil to the emotional exposition of Bones. And these are not just things that like, oh, it's director's choice, oh, whatever. These are fundamentals to what have made these things a success throughout the lifespan, their lifespans. You know, Star Wars, 40 years. Star Trek, 50 years. These are not things to be taken lightly. These are fundamentals. I think if you're not somebody who's actually invested the 3 weeks that it takes without eating or sleeping to look at every single thing made by Star Trek, or to, you know, have to actually sit back and study what's helped to make Star Wars so awesome, you can just kind of discount it and be like, oh, well, it's Abrams. He makes fun stuff.
I mean, here's the thing. Abrams, like we said, he's declared himself over and over a Star Wars fan. And, you know, and that was initially why he didn't even want to touch the property. But I think where you're devolving down at least Star Wars, since that's the series I'm more familiar with, into a single vision when there have been so many different entities, the cartoons, the various shows, even the, you know, old versus new trilogy, which have, I'd say, different spins on that universe. Really, it's really about the universe. And at this point, we don't even know if it's necessarily continuing the Skywalker trilogy or if it's divulging into another separate path.
It's kind of assumed that because this is episode seven, that it's part
trilogy.
Of the
Skywalkers are involved in the whole entire thing. So
I think there should be more Lando. That's all I'm saying.
okay, Black Man.
It's assumed that this is going to be part of the Skywalker saga, and that Disney already has plans for spin-off Star Wars series of films that are going to be still take place in the universe, but not part of the Luke Skywalker canon.
To be clear, there has never been a Star Wars movie that is not part of the Skywalker saga.
Not
the
yet.
Star Wars movies are the Skywalker saga.
Well, no, now, that's, I mean...
Which Star Wars movie did not have a Skywalker as a main character?
No, I'm saying not yet, but the plans moving forward are to have spin-off.
Sure, I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying, to be clear right now, every
single...
The
Christmas special.
Okay, the Christmas special. Now, when it comes to what's canon and what's not, I mean, you can get into that. Lucas himself has said if it's not in one of the movies, it's not really canon. It's just expanded universe. Sure. We'll see what happens. We definitely, I'm sure, want to get more into that universe, because that universe is really where actually most of the Star Wars money has been made. There's a whole bunch of ways to tie that in and make it interesting for the user. What we have seen in the prequel trilogy was that Lucas was more focused on the merchandising in many ways, from some critics' perspective, than the actual story, because that was a toy to sell. Disney has been a good steward of the brand, which is exciting. Brands, they did a very good job with Marvel. I think, despite the most people's hatred of the John Carter film, if Edward Rice Burroughs were to see it, he would say that Disney had been a good steward of his vision. I just hope Abrams will be he'll live up to the expectations of, you know, fans that have been around for this franchise for, you know, 40 years.
You know, in either case, I think it's exciting news, right? It's they at least have someone who, although we'll disagree to varying points, has put out some pretty good films, right? And it's hopefully going to breathe at least some bit of life into a series that has had some issues over the last years. I think there are a couple things which I find pretty interesting to consider. One is soundtrack, right? Because J.J. Abrams usually uses Michael
Giacchino.
Giacchino to do a lot of his films.
I think all of his films. And I think all of his TV projects have at least started with Michael Giacchino as the scorer.
Yeah, and he's
likely going to continue to work with a gentleman like that, because John Williams is for the most part retired. And while I don't think the iconic Star Wars fanfare will be thrown out, I do think that there's plenty of room to make new music.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. And I also heard this is kind of an aside. I also heard that Disney is stopping the releases of the films all converted to 3D.
Yes, so they put hold on that. Quite happy about that.
Me too, actually.
It's wasted effort, really. Like, why waste the time and the money? I mean, it's not for what they get out of it, especially on the prequel trilogy. Just focus those efforts more on making new movies.
Well, I think that the thing about that. Again, people will buy 3D Star Wars movies, especially people who were raised. I mean, the trilogy came out, the prequel trilogy came out 12 years ago now. So if you were a 12-year-old then, that's your trilogy.
Yeah,
that's your baby. So if you got some money today, you're 24 years old, and you know it came out with a 3D version of it. Yeah, you'd check that out. Just like how we ran to the movies 20 years after to check out the updated versions of the original three. 3D wasn't in the cards then, but we did run in 1997 to see what the new CGI was and the new scenes were for it. So I think that there is actually a lot of what they get out of it is a new generation of Star Wars fans who's excited to see what they've seen before in a new way. So I don't think that was necessarily a terrible thing from a business perspective. What I think you're thinking about isn't from a business perspective. It's from that cultural treasure perspective. You want the resources going into a better film in the future, because that was such a dark time for you, because the cultural treasure wasn't respected during those three films. That's where you're coming at, Andy, and that's where I think if you continue that frame of mind, you'll eventually get to where I'm sitting.
All right. Well, I'm willing to give it the benefit of a doubt. Let's wrap this up because I know that we've got to get out of here. Let me go around the table here. I'll start with you, Tosin. Where can we find you on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/toast4321, T-O-A-S-T, 4321. And you can find me discussing films and other random chatter on ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/DwayneD. That's twitter.com/DWAYNED.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com. Or just Google Mr. Baby Man. You'll find all my social links there. Check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. If you go to geeksofdoom.com, you'll find our iTunes link in the upper right-hand sidebar. Our show's on Stitcher. You can subscribe to us on facebook.com/thedrilldown, twitter.com/thedrilldown. Please do that and send us lots of comments and suggestions. We want to hear from you. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that's our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.